DW Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress, coming to you from Bonn, Germany. I'm Sarah Steffen. This week, we'll talk about art and the struggles artists often face. We hear from musicians in India whose craft is on the brink of extinction.
They're connected to their traditional jobs, to their localities. You know, the fishing boatmen of West Bengal sing their own stories. Sufi Kuwals in Rajasthan express their deepest identities through prayer. Dalit dancing communities in Karnataka illustrate their histories. That's why the story of music in these places goes so much deeper than just the sound. Music here is about identity and values.
And ballet teaches girls in the slums of Kenya so much more than just how to dance.
It's the comfort you get from doing the arts. One key thing is how do you express yourself? Then through arts you get to know how to handle other people, how to relate to somebody, how to have like an eye contact if you're going to look for a job somewhere, how to stand when you're asked to explain about yourself.
We'll also learn more about Japan's J-pop industry, so stick around. Hidden in India's hinterlands, there are melodies you've most likely never heard and dances you've never seen and maybe never will. The culture of thousands of Indian tribal artists is slowly vanishing. But two brothers, Shumik and Suvit Datta, set out to record their unique tunes. They traveled to six Indian states, where they met over 100 artists in India's small villages or vast forests for their film project Tuning to You, Lost Musicians of India. Melanie Kuradaval talked to filmmaker Suvit Datta about India's fading traditional folk music and the challenges of preserving that music and people's lifestyles.
A man with long black curly hair wearing a radiant orange kurta plays a two-stringed musical instrument resembling a mandolin. Tarok Dasbal's powerful voice and the sound from his small dotara fill the air in the Shantiniketan village in West Bengal. The music almost sounds like it's from another long-forgotten world, and that's not that far from the truth. Tarok Dasbal's traditional music and rich heritage shares the same fate as that of thousands of tribes across India. It's fading away. That's why two brothers, Suvit and Shomek Datta, visited Tarok Dasbal and over 100 other musicians across six Indian states to record their unique art on film. What they found was an impressive variety of musicians, dancers and instruments, from wandering minstrels in West Bengal and tribal drummers in Rajasthan to dancers in Karnataka and young singers in Goa.
Most of the musicians we met play traditional instruments and melodies that have been around, kind of echoing through their communities for centuries. The artists are well known locally, but they seem increasingly hidden and kind of ignored by the metropolitan mainstream.
That's Suvit Datta, a filmmaker and photographer based in London. He and his brother Shomek, a musician, spent a year recording the forgotten musicians across India. Suvit tells me that globalization and a rapidly changing society have increasingly marginalized Indian folk music. But there are still many torchbearers for their craft hidden in India's small villages and forests.
They're connected to their traditional jobs, to their localities. You know, the fishing boatmen of West Bengal sing their own stories. Sufi Kuwals in Rajasthan express their deepest identities through prayer. Dalit dancing communities in Karnataka illustrate their histories. That's why the story of music in these places goes so much deeper than just the sound. Music here is about identity and values.
For the so-called Bals in West Bengal, for example, music is an all-encompassing way of life. They are wandering minstrels who devote their lives to music and prayer. One of them is Hurui Baul.
The Baul searches for that cosmic power that holds the world. Who runs the universe? What is this power? That's the Baul search.
But those who wander and sing are often hungry. Poverty is but one of the harsh challenges musicians in West Bengal face. But that's not important for the spiritual seekers, as Ruby Baul told the filmmakers.
The devotional Baul connects to his God. He does not worry about food and shelter, money or means, no self-concern at all, no greed, no desire.
But poverty isn't the only challenge for India's marginalized musicians. They also get discriminated against by their own countrymen. On the western plateau of the Indian peninsula in the tropical climes of Karnataka, dancers play dolus, drums hanging from their shoulders, and dance simultaneously to the energetic beat. In the colorful clothing, they recite their history and sagas before they start their striking dance routine. But the iconic dancers and their rich heritage are often not respected because they belong to the Dalit caste, the lowest caste in India's archaic caste system. And despite decades of efforts to end discrimination, Dalits are still sidelined, says Suvit.
And most of Karnataka's Kunita dancers come from this Dalit background, from poorer rural communities of the state. So one of the things we saw here was how artists have to fight societal expectations and prejudices to maintain their art and identity.
But it's not just the continuing prejudice against Dalits that threatens the unique culture of the Kunita dancers and musicians. The rapid economic and social change in India also takes a toll. Many young people are now migrating to urban areas, hoping for a better economic prospect and a life with less oppression.
But those are the very people who, in generations past, would have continued the traditions of their forefathers. You know, now those kids might well be in call centers answering banking queries from people in Europe, or they might be going to university.
But the Dattas also met a few young musicians who keep on performing the traditional music from the places they come from. By the beaches of Goa, where 500 years of Portuguese history merge with Indian culture and stories are told through songs, they met Natia Rebelo. In Goa, Indian culture is still shaped by those colonial influences of Catholicism, Portuguese music and food. It's a state among many in India which has separatist sentiments based on that regional identity. Natia is a young professional fado singer, a style of music which originated in Portugal and has been performed in India since colonial times.
Very few of us sing fado in Goa, and not most youngsters really like fado.
Natia says during the day she does what most young people like doing, chilling in bed, watching TV shows, and going out with friends in the evening. She performs as a fado singer at night. Natia has grown up at the crossroads between a Portuguese Goa heritage and her identity as a young Indian. It is rare to find someone so young making traditional music professionally, but there are some others like her who combine their musical heritage with a modern lifestyle. It's not as simple as to say that everything in rural areas is fading away, Suvit says. But it's true that there are only a few people left being trained in rural folk traditions, and far fewer people in the cities are exposed to these musical styles than just 2 decades ago. And yet, in India's vastness, its mountains, forests and small villages, hidden from most, an impressive variety of tribal and traditional musicians try to persist in their traditional way of life. You just need to listen. For DW, this is Melanie Corradaval.
And for more on that story, check out our Facebook page, DW Global Society. From India, we now turn to Kenya. Art is maybe not the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Kenya's largest slum, Kibera. Fighting poverty and everyday struggles with art and creativity. That's the idea behind One Fine Day, an organization that offers children courses in ballet, art, acrobatics, music and writing. The children love it, and even the parents who were initially skeptical about the program are now convinced. Charlotte Lomas presents this report by Bettina Rühl from Nairobi.
I feel proud of myself because now I can dance, very good. And I always follow what Shamaiki is telling us to do.
For Laventa Chiendu, following the instructions of her dance teacher comes with extra challenges. The 15-year-old dances without ballet shoes, and dancing on pointe is even more difficult when barefoot. But none of the children here in the dance class this afternoon are wearing ballet shoes. That's because they live in Kibera, one of the largest slums in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The boys and girls attend this class as part of their schooling. Behind the timber fence which separates the school from neighbouring properties, you can see the rusted corrugated iron roofs of Kibera's slum huts. Their teacher, Mike Wamaya, grew up in a slum himself.
Life is still hard. We have a lot of crime level. It's hard, but arts have been like a breakthrough, for instance, to me. You know, because if I didn't do the arts, I don't know what I've been doing now. I don't know how I would have been. And that have also perfected me, the way I explain arts to young people outside, because they look at my achievements.
One, up, two, up, three. Up, four, and up, and running it. And over here, and start. And up, and up, and up, and...
At the age of 14, Mike worked as a motor mechanic. By chance, he had heard about a ballet troupe at the National Theatre, which was looking to recruit new young dancers. He applied to join the troupe and was accepted, and with that, his life completely changed.
It's the comfort you get from doing the arts. One key thing is how do you express yourself? Then through arts you get to know how to handle other people, how to relate to somebody, how to have like an eye contact if you're going to look for a job somewhere, how to stand when you're asked to explain about yourself. It's a strength it brings in you that you can apply it in your day-by-day living.
Maria Cott is 14 years old and has been part of the dance class for nearly 5 years. And you can see it's paying off. The ballerina in the white tutu moves smoothly and seemingly effortlessly. Mary's eyes light up as soon as she starts talking about dancing.
I love to dance ballet because it makes my body to be flexible, and I always dance the good. That's why I love it.
Initially, her mother was sceptical, but now she supports her daughter, and Mary knows exactly what she wants.
And I want to keep on trying very hard to get this opportunity one day to become a dancer in future.
To become...
like famous, let's say. Yes, to become famous.
At first, Mary's neighbours in Kibera reacted disapprovingly. They thought ballet was no activity for a kid from the slums. But since then, they've changed their minds and eagerly watch Mary perform.
Because even when I'm home, I dance while, let's say, I'm washing utensils. I stop a little, then start dancing, something like that.
With no mirror in the small slum studio, the dance pupils aren't able to correct their own posture.
Instead, they have to listen to their teacher, Mike, who tirelessly corrects them. Today, they have a special visitor, Isabel Brouwers, a British dancer from the English National Ballet. The young professional dancer watches the children with fascination and doesn't hold back with her praise.
I was watching you during class and I was really impressed. A lot of you are absolutely beautiful. You just need to be more confident and smile, like Mike has been telling you, because if you smile and you're happy dancing, the audience will be happy watching you.
These children from Kibera, along with another troupe of dancers from a slum in Nairobi, will soon perform at Kenya's National Theatre. They've already started rehearsals for a musical, which they are creating all by themselves. Behind the project are British organisation Anors Africa and German organisation One Fine Day. Ballet teacher Mike says the upcoming musical performance at the National Theatre is an important step for these children.
People still say, whoa, they're beautiful, but they're coming from the slums. But as we are like, we want to compete with the world. That's why we do ballet also. We want to be put on the same level with everyone else in the world.
Charlotte Lomas with a report by Bettina Rühl. You're listening to DW's What in Progress, coming to you from Bonn, Germany. You can find more of our content online and on our Facebook page, DW Global Society. Still to come, Japan's tough J-pop industry and how to be creative under the grip of a dictator in Zimbabwe. These are dark times for Zimbabwe. The country is in the grip of an aging dictator and corrupt elite who put their own interests above the prosperity of the citizens. The economy has collapsed. There are hardly any jobs, and millions of Zimbabweans have left the country in recent years in search of a better life elsewhere. Hope is in short supply. But there are oases of optimism. Jan-Philipp Schlüter discovered a creative hub in the capital of Harare that's shining a ray of light into the country's gloomy future. Anke Raspa presents his report.
It's a Saturday afternoon in Harare. Music blares across a plot of land in the city's popular district, the Avenues. Burgers and chicken drumsticks sizzle on a barbecue. Beer and cocktails are poured. Young fashion designers are selling their creations, clothes and accessories laid out on folding tables. This is the monthly Hustlers Market, where Harare's hip young creatives get together. The site belongs to Moto Republic, which co-founder Farai Monroe calls Harare's first creative center.
It was very much about trying to create a space where young people could come together, work together, dream together, share together, collaborate together, in a space where we can start, you know, dreaming and building the Zimbabwe we want and not being held back by current economic and political circumstances.
Farai's words are a refreshing contrast to those you hear from most Zimbabweans these days. A dark cloud hangs over the country. Go to the city centre and you'll see long queues at ATM machines, where people wait for hours in the hope of getting hold of a little cash. Talk to them and the same sentiments will come up again and again. It's hard. We struggle to survive and hopefully it will get better someday. The last with grim resignation.
Of course you can't suffer like this. It's enough, no?
The Moto Republic Creative Center is a strikingly modern construction in this neighborhood of old-style houses. It's cleverly built from shipping containers, painted black, and adorned with a graphic pattern of red and gray panels. The interior is a clean, minimal space, the furniture handmade from recycled wooden pallets and glass. It's a space for bloggers, designers, journalists and activists to get together. They pay anywhere from $15 to $100 a month for a place to work, high-speed internet and creative workshops. But above all, they come for the contacts they make here, says manager Locke.
Come here, see who you meet, and whatever your thoughts and your feelings and however you want to express yourself creatively, how are you guys going to put that forward and what does it mean and how can it impact a positive, new, young Zimbabwe?
The center's most famous products are The Week and Zimbabwean News, two satirical video formats, mainly distributed on social media and popular with young Zimbabweans. The videos can rack up 50,000 clicks. Motor Republic founder Farai Monroe, aka Comrade Fazo, is the face of political satire in Zimbabwe.
Ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, welcome to the week with me, Comrade Fazo, where we bring you the news faster than it takes to resurrect yourself from the dead and say, I was just shopping in Dubai.
Other regulars at the center include the brains behind Zimbabwe's hashtag movements, activists who organize mainly on social networks like Facebook, WhatsApp and Twitter. They've been demonstrating vociferously in Harare over recent months and are almost always met with heavy police resistance. Little wonder, then, that the Zimbabwean security forces keep a close watch on Motor Republic.
We have the CID, the police. We get a lot of focus on our different projects because of, I think, the political nature of them. Just this year, a few months ago, the police internal security intelligence were threatening to arrest us, saying that we were, you know, pushing a regime change agenda and wanting to kill the president. And so we get to know very well all the different government departments and how many different types of police exist in this country.
Motor Republic is more than a trendy co-working space. It aims to be a nucleus for ideas and projects that will engender a better future for Zimbabwe, says Kundai, a young journalist who is here working on his website.
I think we need more spaces like this because they kind of give us hope that things will turn out for the best. And as the community hub manager usually says, some of the ideas that will bring solutions to Zimbabwe will actually come from the creative sector.
Zimbabwe is still ruled by the men who fought the civil war in the 1950s and 60s to free the country from white colonial rule. Men like the authoritarian president, 93-year-old Robert Mugabe, and his deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who's in his 70s. But Locke, the manager of Motor Republic, sees their time coming to an end.
Well, they're not going to be around that long, and we're next.
Anke Rasper with that report by Jan-Philipp Schlüter. Moving on to Japan now, where a style of Japanese pop called J-pop is widely popular. It's a cutthroat industry where groups of young men and women sing and dance to bubblegum pop while selling their good looks, cuteness and charm. But beneath this squeaky clean image is a dark reputation of low pay, long hours and tightly controlled social lives. Tisanka Siripala met up with the lead singer of a new girl group to find out what it's like to train and perform for one of Japan's biggest J-pop talent agencies.
There's an addictive quality to J-pop that's designed to entice teeny boppers. The performers are known as idols. With high school girls fueling the hysteria, it's no surprise joining an idol group is a dream shared by many young women. It's a dream Chiyomona had too. The 23-year-old is half Japanese and half Chinese. She studied at an international high school in China and is fluent in three languages. She was picked to be the lead singer of a new J-pop group called Deaf Wheel, signed to major label Avex after being scouted by music legend Komuro Tetsuya, known as the godfather of J-pop. Backstage at their live show, she says she prefers to be called a singer rather than an idol. But working with a famous producer has its perks.
Everything is actually super new. We don't have much fans yet. But like most of our fans are from Komuro-san's fans. The age group is a bit older. And then that's really weird because we thought our music is towards younger generation.
2 years ago, Chiyo was studying at Tokyo's prestigious Waseda University while pursuing her singing career. She sent her demos to major music labels, only to be turned down by all except one.
I went to an audition for Sunny, and they didn't like me at all. And then everyone else was like super skinny and super cute. And then really, they have a really cute voice. Then my voice was really like mature. They just didn't even ask any question of me. They're so obviously not interested in me. So after that audition, I kind of lost faith. I was like, oh, maybe I can be a singer in Japan because that's what not what they want.
Now, J-pop supergroups like AKB48 have sold more than 200 million records. They've built an empire, crafting their stage personality and likability, centered around the concept of kawaii, or cuteness. Kazuto Okawa is a solo electronic musician under the name of 4L. For 10 years, he's been composing hit singles for some of Japan's most successful female pop artists. He says idols are in a business of selling a fantasy of purity and naivety. It's not a platform to prove you're the best singer or dancer.
As a composer and music producer, I know software is like auto-correcting vocal lines and whatnot, becoming a default of production. But I think the more to do is like a charisma, for instance, you know, what sort of image do you have on Instagram, you know, on SNS, like what kind of personality?
Music label and talent agency Avex specializes in producing solo stars like Amuro Namiya and Ayumi, which are household names in Japan. Chiyo says each member of Death Wheel was scouted individually, an unusual strategy for a J-pop group. It's no coincidence some of the members are multilingual. Together they line up backstage, ready to greet music industry officials the traditional Japanese way, with a bow and a humble how do you do. Being an idol is more than a 9-to-5 job. It's a vow to an arduous daily routine. Chiyo says she juggles 4 vocal coaches, private lessons, group practice, and occasional acting lessons. She dances for up to 6 hours a day, every day.
They're quite pushing us, every one of us. But then I don't think they're pushing me in a hard way. Yeah, they want us not only to be an like normal idol, they want us to have our own value. So they pay for our concert, also books. Like they want us to learn about politics. They want us to be like the girl that every Japanese girl wants to be, a role model instead of idol.
In addition to the demanding routines, there's also strict rules. Many idol groups have a no-dating policy for their members to preserve the illusion of youthful innocence and availability. In 2013, one founding member of AKB48 was caught with a boyfriend and demoted. The scandal was picked up by international media when the member shaved her head and issued a teary public apology. Chiyo admits joining a J-pop group usually means saying goodbye to dating, going out and posting freely on social media. She says she is allowed a partner, but doesn't have the time.
My manager actually asked me last week, wait, you should find a boyfriend. And then I was like, why? And then she's like, then you can understand the lyrics, then you can understand the song. Because we're singing about love, but if we don't love, then that's weird if you're singing a love song, but you cannot have a boyfriend, right?
Idol groups in Japan navigate a delicate realm of adorable and suggestive, just enough to tease fans. But Chiyo says, unlike other groups, Death Wheel has free rein over the kind of image they want to project.
I always ask for like costumes that shows my belly and stuff. And I told my manager I really like how my butt looks. Like it's so different from J-pop. And then they never tell you, oh, your butt is too fat. That part of Death Wheel is really free because our target customers are not men. We want girls to like fall in love with us.
Early in her career, Chiyo was still finding her feet. For the moment, she's not tied up with slotting into a specific category or definition. Even so, she represents a new breed of J-pop singers, ready to give other groups a run for their money. Tsanka Sirapala, DW, Tokyo.
And that's all we had time for today on World in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/World in Progress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Just search for DW English. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliane Gilyaducci and Jürgen Kuhn. I'm Sarah Steffen and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.